Good afternoon. It is 12:02. It's Friday. We've got, well, not too much sun, but we had some. Anyway, I'm Eric Scott. Good afternoon. Of course, being Friday, Senator Jeb Bradley is with us, Wolfboro resident, Senate Majority Leader. Senator, thank you again for making the time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, big news, of course, the Build Back Better bill has passed. And if you were listening to the news just a couple of minutes ago, it seems that according to the story, every business-focused advocacy group is against this. Maybe you can kind of help me in this. I'm trying to stay nonpartisan on this as well. What is wrong with investing in our infrastructure?
Well, Eric, let's remember there were two bills.
Right.
The bill that passed and was signed into law earlier this week by President Biden, and remember he did a bill, whatever you want to call it, signing in Woodstock at a bridge. You know, I think it was on Tuesday. That is a what you would, I think, consider, you know, hard infrastructure type of bill, roads, bridges, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
This bill is a whole collection of other things that, you know, are a wish list for the president and his allies. And it just, you know, it's a huge, almost $2 trillion worth of social spending, not on roads and bridges, but, you know, on everything from the Green New Deal to child care type things that just is, in my opinion, going to really exacerbate the inflationary pressures in the United States. And much of it, I think, is unrealistic, not paid for. It'll increase the deficit remarkably. The thrust of government will just get bigger and bigger in people's lives. So, you know, we'll see what happens. It's got a long ways to go because I suspect that there are at least, you know, two Democratic senators and probably a couple more that, given, you know, where the polling is on this bill and the president's polling in general, are going to be reluctant to vote for it. But we'll see what happens. That's what keeps it interesting.
Well, theoretically, all the senators are on board, or we're supposed to be on board, but maybe not.
No. I mean, Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema, I don't think you could say that they're on board.
So the bill has little chance of passing in the Senate?
Well, I'm not sure I'd say it has little chance of passing. I think it's got a long ways to go. I you know, if Senator Manchin sticks to, you know, what he has said, then, yeah, it's not going to pass. But, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe the Senate can rewrite the bill, okay? So this is not like the vote a couple of weeks ago that was in the House on, you know, the Senate passed infrastructure bill. So the House went and, you know, passed what the Senate had passed, and it went to the president. The Senate will have the opportunity to amend it, you know, and make, could be, pretty significant changes.
You think so? They won't have an up or down vote on it?
I doubt it. I doubt it very much. I mean, that's the process, that it'll be subject to amendment, and we'll, you know, we'll see what happens. So.
See, I was under the impression that it was going to pass relatively soon, but it doesn't look that way, does it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. While we're on that subject, could some reluctant Democratic voters have to do with the midterms coming up?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I haven't seen the roll call yet, but, you know, I would imagine that virtually every House Democrat voted for the bill because they can only lose a handful of votes. And I don't think that there was any Republican support for it. I'm sort of scrolling through websites right now trying to figure it out, but I think that virtually every Democrat must have voted for it because they only have a 5-vote majority.
Is that all it is, 5 votes?
Yes.
Okay, and it's 50-50 in the Senate, right?
Yes, and presumably if they have all 50 Democratic senators, and there's not a single Republican senator that has indicated they're on board with, you know, what the president is proposing, they'd have to have all 50 Democratic senators, and then Vice President Harris could be the tie-breaking vote.
Right. Now, what, if anything, does this have to do with the debt limit and budget problems coming up in about 2.5 weeks?
So they're separate. The vote for extending the debt ceiling is a separate vote. And generally speaking, there's negotiation that comes together on that because you have to pay for, you know, past bills of, you know, the country. And generally speaking, there's some bipartisan support because, you know, the spending is generally speaking got some bipartisan support. So, you know, a vote to extend the debt ceiling generally after some negotiation goes through. Okay. But this time, because of the Build Back Better $2 trillion bill, a vote to extend the debt ceiling is also being perceived as a vote that will allow the proponents of extending the debt ceiling to go ahead and do it. So there isn't the bipartisan support at this point in time. And so I suspect that that's why the Senate leadership, Senator Schumer, is going to slow walk the Build Back Better bill until there's an agreement on the debt ceiling.
Why are, and I know you mentioned it, but why are all the Republicans so united in their opposition to this thing? Without it, we default on our obligations.
Well, and the reason, as I just indicated, is that if you extend the debt ceiling, you're making it easier to fit this $2 trillion into the nation's spending plan. And that's why Republicans are objecting to it, because it doesn't have any bipartisan support.
Right, but isn't the budget ceiling money that we've already spent?
No.
Okay.
The budget ceiling is money, yes, you're correct in that. It's money that we've already spent, but I think with justification, Republicans are seeing it as, okay, if we go along with this and we extend the debt ceiling to whatever, it's $30-31 trillion, that will enable the Democrats to move forward with the Build Back Better bill, which is another $2 trillion that has no bipartisan support.
So defaulting is a better option than...
Well, I don't think that'll happen.
Okay.
And that's what I mean by there's going to have to be some negotiations, and that's why I don't think you'll find a vote anytime soon on Build Back Better. because first of all, they don't have the votes. So, you know, until Manchin and Sinema, and probably a couple of other Democratic senators, you know, have signaled that they're ready to vote for the Build Back Better, Schumer would be better advised to try to get the debt ceiling bill through. And whether they could use reconciliation, which is a 50-vote vote on the debt ceiling, to, you know, lift the debt ceiling. They could do that. The Democrats could do that. It is within the rules of what a 50-vote, you know, way of proceeding in the Senate is. Most things that are not budget-related have to have 60 votes. That's the, you know, checks and balances of our system in the United States. But this is a budget issue. And so under the rules of the Senate, they could go forward with a straight party line vote. And so Republicans are arguing, okay, use reconciliation. You can do it with 50 votes plus the vice presidents. And we're not going to, you know, help you spend the next $2 trillion that we don't agree with, that, you know, President Biden wants to spend. Now, let's remember, we're running pretty significant deficits on a yearly basis anyway, with, you know, all of the spending for Medicaid, Medicare, you know, interest on the national debt, plus all of the other programs that we have. So I think with justification, you know, and with the fact that we're seeing what the results of all this spending is, inflation, and significant inflation, the worst in 30 to 40 years, Republicans are saying, they're tapping the brakes and saying, whoa, time out here. And they're just not willing to enable another $2 trillion of what they, and I think rightfully so, perceive this Build Back Better spending to be is just not good for the country.
Now, how long, from what I've heard, a reconciliation vote could take weeks. Why is that?
It's just the process. It's why it's very frustrating to be in Washington. You know, I guess you'd call it good news and bad news at the same time. We have checks and balances. And so the House in Washington can move, you know, more adroitly. They have the votes, they pass it. Okay, they don't have the votes, they don't bring it up. That's how it works in the U.S. House. In the Senate, because most things have to have 60 votes, it generally speaking, it's very rare that the United States Senate has 60 votes. The one recent exception to that was in 2009. There were 60 votes, and they passed Obamacare. That was the one exception to that. So you, in order to do legislation in the United States Senate, you have to have, generally speaking, bipartisan support. So, you know, some would argue that's a good thing. Others would argue the process is just interminable and nothing gets done. So sometimes, as I think I'm articulating right now, let's, you know, hold off on some of this unnecessary spending, so let's hit the brakes. That's what, you know, has been built into the procedures of the United States Senate for a long time. The founders of this country built the system in such a way that there were checks and balances, and this is definitely the rules of the United States Senate is definitely one of the checks to make sure that there's consensus before broad, you know, changes are made. So,
now, are the rules subject to possible change? I keep hearing every so often about the so-called nuclear option, but I don't really know much about it.
Okay, so the nuclear option is if you change the rules to move to 51 votes, a simple majority as opposed to a supermajority, would basically end the what's known as the filibuster or the supermajority, which used to be 67 votes. Now it's 60. Okay, so that got changed. I'm trying to remember when Harry Reid was Senate Majority Leader, to allow judicial nominees to go through on a majority vote. Okay, and but it wasn't changed for other policy, except for budgets. Budgets, I guess, are seen as something that has to happen every year, so it's must-pass legislation. So over the last period of time, both sides, Republicans and Democrats, had agreed on the rules for budget reconciliation, which allows something to go through with 51 votes. But other big policy, like Obamacare, immigration reform would be another issue. A big change on, climate legislation, for instance, that would be 60 votes. So big policy votes need 60 in the Senate. They could change the rules, okay? And it's interesting now because, the very Democrats that, were against changing the filibuster rules, when Republicans last controlled the United States Senate in 2017 and 18, a lot of them are now advocating for changing the rules. It all depends on who's in power. And so I think, generally speaking, our nation is better protected by having this check on, just big policy swings and changes. That being said, you can make the opposing argument that the check is so hard to overcome that nothing gets done. Sometimes nothing is a better option than something. And I think, this $2 trillion, given the magnitude of our debt and deficit right now and the corresponding inflation that it's causing, a check is a good thing.
Could inflation have other causes as well? I know that there's been a lot of economic stimulus on the Fed level. They've been buying billions of dollars worth of bonds every month. Other things
those
like
things
that.
Contribute. Those things contribute. But okay. There's been a huge amount of money that's been pumped into the system because of COVID. All right. So that was, that was under President Trump, much of it, not all of it, but a lot of it, and Republicans and Democrats voted for it to pull the country through and to make sure the people that, couldn't work because of COVID, didn't slip through the cracks, okay? So that had an impact, no question about it, all that federal money. Now what we're doing is putting another $5 trillion, potentially, on top of that, with the ARPA money, the infrastructure bill that the president signed a few days ago, and this $2 trillion Build Back Better bill. And that is clearly one of the biggest contributing factors to inflation. You're right, quantitative easing, things like that, low interest rates from the Fed, that has an impact. Another thing that has a huge impact is what President Biden has done directly in curtailing American energy production. And so when you cancel the Keystone Pipeline, when you cancel federal leasing, when you make it really difficult for fossil fuel industries to invest in the upkeep and the maintenance, to say nothing of the R&D and development of new technologies to keep producing, gas, home heating fuels, all the things that Americans depend on, what do you get? Well, you get a 60% increase in the price of gasoline in the last 10 months in this country, and, home heating costs for, folks in New England and across the country is going through the roof. When energy goes through the roof, Eric, that is a huge inflationary pressure on the entire economy also.
Right, and it hits the people that can afford it the least.
Exactly. And I think that's why, you know, President Biden's poll numbers are tanking. And, you know, people are pretty upset. And if you look at the, you know, one of the key questions all these polls ask is America or is New Hampshire on the right track or the wrong track? And, you know, it's a key polling question, right track, wrong track. And overwhelming majorities of Americans now are saying we're on the wrong track. And it's, you know, they're feeling it when they fill up their cars, when they put fuel in their, you know, tanks to heat with. They're feeling it when they're buying food every week at the supermarket. They're feeling it in a whole range of goods and services. And, oh, by the way, a lot of short shelves are empty because of supply chain shortage. And that, again, you know, is a result of decisions being made in Washington. When you pay people not to work, you have, you know, less people working. So, of course, you have shortages of truckers and you have, you know, 70 ships off the coast of California that can't unload, you know, and that's causing inflation. And so, you know, the wrong track, and it's not just economy. You have rising crime all across the country, and you have the chaos at the border. You have Afghanistan and Americans being left behind. I mean, anywhere you look right now, people are pretty upset, and upset for a reason, because, you know, the pandemic hasn't been, you know, solved. You got the president trying to mandate people get vaccinated or lose their jobs. I mean, you know, this kind of thing is, you know, that's why so many people are saying, whoa, we're on the wrong track.
I talked to a friend of mine recently, and he said that he thought the Republicans could pick up as many as 100 seats in the midterms. I've never seen anything like that. As usual, I think you know much better than I do, the party in power tends to lose seats in the midterms. What do you see for them? Do you see a big Republican pickup?
So, you know, I think most experts, you know, think that Republicans are going to do just fine next year. 100 seats, I think, is wildly optimistic. I've seen, you know, Newt Gingrich has been on TV saying it could be 60 or 70. You know, again, one thing I would caution, and I know this from, you know, my own experience, you know, let's just wait and see what happens a year from now before we start saying, oh, this is definitely going to happen or that is definitely going to happen. Things can change. Now, I think that, you know, the Biden administration, given what happened in Virginia and almost happened in New Jersey with the gubernatorial elections and the fear of, you know, a realignment in Congress, has not switched course. You know, they haven't tried to strengthen border security. Americans are still stranded. They are doubling down on all the spending initiatives. So does that mean things are going to be the same in a year, or they're going to get better, or they're going to get worse? I mean, who knows? But I would say this, you know, when President Clinton was confronted with, you know, this type of situation in 1994, he tacked to the middle, and he was able to win election in 1996 because he went back to the middle. Right now, the Biden administration is not trying to go back to the middle. They're, you know, rushing headlong to the left. And so if they continue to do that, I think it definitely sets the stage for people to say enough already. They're betting that, you know, if they head to the left far enough and they're successful, that everybody's going to love it. That's what they're betting on. I don't think that's going to be the case. But, you know, that's what elections determine.
True.
And we can prognosticate all we want. You know, it's now actually less than a year, you know, 11 and a half months away. But, you know, I know that you can never be certain of what's going to happen a year from now. I feel pretty good, but, you know, am I going to bet the farm on it? Not yet.
No, I can't blame you there. 12:27, we're talking with Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, and who is talking to us from Wolfboro. Thank you very much. 569-5253, if you would like to get in and ask the senator a question. So we're talking about, well, let's kind of move the discussion to New Hampshire.
By the way, yes. I've gone through the website now on the vote.
Oh, yes.
Both Congress members from New Hampshire, Congresswoman Pappas and Congresswoman Custer, sorry, and Congressman Pappas both voted for the spending bill, the $2 trillion bill.
Yeah, that's not a huge surprise, I think.
No, not a huge surprise.
Now, you had mentioned that back, you know, before that there was attack to the center with, I think, and I have nothing to base this on other than just my life experience. I think the vast majority of Americans are somewhere in the center. Why is it that the Republicans seem to be tacking right while the Republicans tack left? Isn't that counterproductive? Or does it show that we're the anti-Democrat?
I think comes down to a lot of what happens in our primary system, where, you know, a lot of people don't vote in primaries. And so the more left wing and the more left right wing candidates often win, and they become, the leaders to speak, I guess, of their party. And generally speaking, the U.S. Senate is a check on that because it takes bipartisan cooperation. It just seems that our country right now is so polarized that, there's no bridge over the divide, which is unfortunate. I've always tried to be a center of the road Republican, a conservative, but somebody that is willing to work with Democrats and solve problems. And I think we need more of that in Washington. I try to do that. Some people would say I probably do too much of it. Other people would say I don't do enough of it. But that's how I try to be. But we're oftentimes surrounded on both the left and the right by folks that are, further to the left and further to the right than the center. And I agree with you. Americans are more in the middle, but, oftentimes it comes down to, people that get nominated that may be either more left-leaning or more right-leaning than, especially in New Hampshire, where 40%+ of voters are independents. They probably like more centrist candidates. And I think, Eric, that's why Governor Sununu's done pretty well, because he is a moderate. He's a problem solver. He's a conservative. He's, out to protect taxpayers, but he's also, somebody that has worked for economic growth and worked to solve problems. I mean, expanding health care that we did with Medicaid expansion a few years ago. I mean, so, I think people support that in the center, and I think that's why, he's pretty popular.
Are you glad that he's running for governor again instead of Senate?
As I said all throughout this process, I think that, he's been a great governor, and, he's deserved the space to make a decision on what was best for him and his party. I mean, him and his family. And I think he's done that. So, we'll see what happens. But I think, he'll be very formidable in running again for the governorship.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about redistricting, if you don't mind. for whatever reason, this seems to pop up every time it happens. It becomes a very partisan issue. Is it, maybe, again, I'm just being politically naive, but if you just kind of, you say, okay, we have two districts, we put X number of people in each district, roughly even, and call it a day. Do we have to start gerrymandering maps to make sure that a Republican or a Democrat is more likely to win the seat?
So, you know, let me say this. I mean, obviously, I've seen the maps. There's a whole long process, you know, to go through. It's very possible it's going to change in the House. The Senate has to have a public hearing, and, you know, is going to have a vote on it. It could change in the Senate. The governor gets, you know, his say on, you know, the matter. So the one thing I would say is in the Senate, you know, we'll have an open and transparent process. And I guess the only comment I would make at this point is that, you know, I don't think that as a Republican we should be just saying, okay, we're going to give up on the second congressional district, that we can't win it, and that, you know, we're going to put part of the Seacoast in with Nashua and make a, you know, Democratic stronghold so that the, you know, center part of the state, if you will, can elect a Republican. I think that both congressional districts will be competitive next year if they didn't change at all. So that concerns me.
In what way?
Because I don't think Republicans should give up on being able to elect a Republican in the second congressional district by making the first congressional district almost impossible to elect a Democrat. So that's my concern at this point. But I really can't say too much more until, you know, the bill gets to the Senate and we have a chance to, you know, look at it ourselves.
But this is just the beginning of a process.
It's a long process, yes.
Okay. By the way, a little bit of breaking news. It's snowing outside our studios.
Yeah.
Believe it or not.
Some breaking news for you, too. I understand the fiscal committee just approved the Department of Health and Human Services proposal to accept federal funds to enhance vaccine efforts around New Hampshire, which I think is a good thing.
Good. I wanted to talk about that anyway. That was the money that was originally refused?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So it's now been approved.
What, if you know, happened to get them to change their mind?
Well, they, at the executive council level, passed a resolution that was against, you know, the mandatory vaccines being proposed by, you know, the Biden administration. And I think that was what helped get the initiative across the finish line. The other thing, too, was I think people realized that this was about trying to improve access, especially for youngsters and boosters in the vaccine effort. So I think, you know, 80% of New Hampshire is vaccinated at this point, according to, you know, what I've read, both, you know, surveys by U.S. News and World Reports that are based on CDC, as well as UNH polling that just came out, I think, today, that indicates that about 80% of folks in New Hampshire are vaccinated. That's a choice that people have made, that, you know, they've weighed the risks, they've weighed the benefits, and 80% of us, myself included, have decided to get vaccinated. I looked at the, you know, impact of what COVID would be on a, you know, 69-year-old, mostly healthy, you know, geezer like myself, and determined, yeah, you know, with the advice of my doctor, I should get vaccinated. I did. I got the booster, and I'm glad I did, you know, and still doesn't mean I won't get COVID it may prevent me from getting COVID, who knows? But if I get COVID, the chances of it being, dire are far, far less. So I decided personally that the benefits outweighed the risks, okay? But if I were a seven-year-old kid, or a parent of a seven-year-old kid, and my kids were healthy, I might say, I might want to wait, because it is, while it's been approved by the FDA, it hasn't had the same amount of time for, you know, conclusive medical studies. And young kids are the least impacted by COVID. So I think, you know, parents should have the, they should have the ability, if they want to make a choice, to get vaccinated. But I don't think there should be a mandate to get vaccinated, okay? And I don't think that, the Biden administration should be threatening people with loss of jobs if they choose not to get vaccinated, because I think for some adults, there are legitimate issues too. I mean, young men, myocarditis, that's an issue. And, you know, you can wish it away, but it isn't going away. A lot of doctors are cautious about recommending, you know, women of childbearing age getting the vaccine. A lot of people don't think it's necessary to get the vaccine if you've already had COVID. And a lot of people have already had COVID. So, and then some people just, they have religious views. Some people, their doctors don't recommend a vaccine for various reasons that are particular to their health circumstances. I asked my doctor, I said, "Doc, you know, what are you doing? What are you recommending to people, you know?" And he said, "Look," he said, "I review everybody's, you know, personal medical history. I have a conversation with people. Most people, I'm recommending that they, you know, get vaccinated. But there are some individuals who are probably better advised not to." So, you know, this one size fits all, Joe Biden knows best, you know, is, I think it's just not necessary. And it's certainly not necessary to be firing people when there are some valid questions still about, you know, the vaccine. Most of us have taken it, and I think most people support that. But firing people, mm-mm. And so that's where, you know, trying to promote the vaccine on a voluntary basis and make sure people have access to it, that's good, okay? But then saying, "Oh, you're going to lose your job," or any number of other things if you're not vaccinated, that goes way too far. And, you know, as I think I expressed last week on this show, Eric, you know, I'm fully vaccinated. But as I said before, it doesn't mean I can't get COVID. And I can't pass it to somebody, whether they're vaccinated or unvaccinated. So, you know, this one size fits all, we're going to, you know, force people to lose their job if they don't want to get vaccinated, I don't like that. And I think another reason why people feel that the president's overreached, way overreached. It's one thing to, you know, be advocating for the vaccine. It's another thing to be mandating it. This is different, especially for kids, than diseases like polio or diphtheria or whooping cough, that, especially polio, that can be, you know, so devastating. It's different.
Is there, let me put it another way. Do you think that our vaccination rate will improve much, or has it hit pretty much about as high as it's going to get?
So at 80%, we're doing pretty well, I think. Might get a little higher. We might get up to 85% over time. And I think that's probably, you know, about where it is. I think most youngsters and even teenagers are really not at risk for COVID. Now, if that changes, okay, let's say there was a variant. We have the Delta variant. Let's say we have the Alpha variant, okay? And I'm just, you know, speculating at this point that, you know, was deadly to kids. Then I think the dynamic changes and parents would say, yeah, I want my kids to get vaccinated. But right now, I just don't think that given the low risk profile for most kids and the fact that the vaccination is not foolproof in terms of, you know, preventing somebody from getting COVID. The best thing about the vaccine is if you've had the vaccine, you're far, far, far less likely to have, you know, debilitating health outcomes, death or hospitalization. That is very well documented. But a lot of people have had the vaccine and gotten COVID. They may even be asymptomatic, but they can pass it to other people. So, you know, again, that's why I think the mandatory nature that, you know, the Biden administration is proposing for large companies and federal contractors, you know, is an overreach and, you know, is not necessary. And I think, you know, as I've urged healthcare providers in New Hampshire, they're in a bit different circumstance because they, you know, deal with people in nursing homes or hospitals or, you know, physicians' office. And so it's a little bit different, and I don't think government should dictate, you know, to businesses or, you know, healthcare organizations what they can and can't do. But I think that they should allow for medical exemptions and religious exemptions. And I think people, you know, have a right to those. Historically, there's always been a right to those in vaccine policy, whether it's, you know, preschool, school age, or anyone else. And I think that, you know, a little bit of flexibility on the medical and religious exemptions would go a long ways.
Well, what I don't understand is why there isn't the, what we used to call the alternative method of entry. If you're not vaccinated, maybe you should take a COVID test once a week. Wouldn't that solve
and
the problem?
Yes. But here's the problem with that, okay? The COVID tests are not cheap. Regardless of who pays for it, if it's the government, if it's the business, if it's the hospital, or if it's the individual, they're about $200 a pop. I, you know, a couple of months ago, you know, I thought I had the beginnings of a cold. My nose was running, a bit of a sore throat. So I trucked on down to Alton to, you know, convenient MD, and the really nice people took me 3 trips to actually be able to get in line to get the test because there was so much demand for it, and it was $200. Now, the Biden administration has said, okay, well, you can weekly test. So what's $200 times 52 weeks, okay? It's $10,400. That's a lot of money for anybody to have a test that often. So it just, it's impractical.
Okay, but you can understand where the pro-vaccine people are coming from. I mean, they're not looking for people
that say. I think that it's the pro-vaccine is as much political as it is health-related, okay? If 80 to 85% of us are vaccinated, we're going to develop, you know, what's known as herd immunity. And the variants will, they'll still be with us, but their harmful impact diminishes, okay? And as I keep stressing, vaccination is not a preventative from getting COVID, okay? Its best thing is it mitigates the symptoms. You can still get it. You can pass it to somebody else, whether they're vaccinated or unvaccinated. And that's well documented. So the vaccine is not a panacea in terms of eradicating COVID. It is very helpful in terms of mitigating the symptoms and for society being able to live with COVID, which is, quite frankly, I think, you know, what we're going to have to do, given that the vaccine is not it doesn't prevent you from getting COVID. So, the pro-vaccine people are just looking at it as a one-size-fits-all solution that's driven by politics as much as science, and they're saying, oh, everybody should get vaccinated. But even if we all got vaccinated, people would still get COVID. And so let's not, take away people's right of choice. And then for some people, the risk of myocarditis or, women of childbearing age, and in particular for people that have already had COVID, that the vaccine is nowhere near as effective as the antibodies that your body has already produced by virtue of the fact that you've had COVID. That's the flaw in the, everybody get vaccinated argument. It's just, it's not going to prevent COVID.
Right. And it's funny because people take the flu vaccine, which they know is in some cases less than 50% effective. And yes, it's you don't get it as badly where you just, we've all had the flu where you just lay there and want to die. But, people aren't. I mean, there are more realistic expectations for the flu virus than there are for the COVID-19 virus. And I wonder if that's the political part that you're talking about.
I think it's just become so highly politicized that it's impossible for people, to just look at the science of it and accept that, some people either don't want to be vaccinated or it's not in their best health interest to be vaccinated. I mean, I've had people tell me, look, I've already had COVID. I got the vaccine. I got really sick. So, if it's not going to produce anything that's helpful for you after you've already had COVID, why do it? Now, 3 or 4 years from now, when we have more data, we revisit these things. But I think by that point in time, hopefully, we've gotten through the worst of it. Gotten through the worst of it, and this debate becomes moot.
Well, it does. It does. Then, unfortunately, we can only work on what we know now.
I agree.
Right.
But I think we know quite a bit now, and 80% of New Hampshire being vaccinated—that's a good thing.
Why is New Hampshire's rate so relatively high compared to so many other states?
I think, perhaps it's because we're an older population. And I think people do their homework. And I think, if you talk to your doctor, most doctors are recommending for most of their patients, that they get vaccinated. I think people accept it. And I think, and people in New Hampshire are pretty independent minded. So what you see in maybe some other states where there's political pressure to get vaccinated in some places or in some other places to not get vaccinated because of politics, I think you maybe see less of that in New Hampshire. I don't know. But I'm speculating. I really don't know.
Are there more independents in New Hampshire than in many other states?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I know that that's the largest voting block in New Hampshire. 40-45% of people are independent. But
why do you think they're independent? I mean, I'm one myself, but I definitely, I lean libertarian, but I just decided that I wasn't ready to be a member of a political party.
Yeah, no, I think that people in New Hampshire are just, they're independent-minded. Starts with our state motto, live free or die. And people in New Hampshire don't like being told what to do. They like to think for themselves. They don't, necessarily, want to affiliate with a political party. And then you throw, gridlock in Washington that we've seen for the last 20-plus years, 30-plus years, I can understand why people would want to be independent. I mean, I'm proud to be a Republican, but, you know, as I said before, I like to work with independents, and I don't have a problem working with Democrats either. No one has a monopoly, Eric, on good ideas, and no one has a monopoly on the best way to get to yes. And the best way, you know, to move our state country forward is working together. That's what I try to do as much as I possibly can. As I said before, some people think I probably do it too much. Other people think I do it too little. But I do try. I always listen. As I tell people, you know, the good Lord gave me two ears and one mouth. So listen a little bit more than you talk.
I've found it interesting that New Hampshire is definitely an outlier when it comes to certain things. I believe we are the only state without an adult seatbelt law, which is kind of strange. I'm surprised we haven't lost any federal highway money, or have we?
I don't believe we have, and I don't know if we're the only state or not. I think we are. But I think if you look at our statistics as to, you know, voluntary seatbelt use, you know, we rate fairly highly compared to states that have mandatory seatbelt laws. So, I mean, I get in the car, the beeper goes off, I buckle up. And, you know, the technology today in most cars is you're just going to be harassed by the beeping in your car if you don't buckle up. And
yep.
I guess you can disable it. Most people don't. Most people buckle up, and I think it's just a philosophical thing. You don't need to be told by government to buckle up.
Well, that sounds a lot like the vaccine question.
Or pulled over and fined for not buckling up. Right. So, you know, it's not just a, you know, nanny statism. You can actually be fined.
Well, that's part of the, you know, that's goes with the nanny state, that, you know, they know better than we do what's best for us. And
exactly.
Is that part of what's behind this vaccine mandate, is people just don't like being told?
I think that's part of it, but I also think that there's more to it than that. I think, as I've outlined before, let me try to do it succinctly. There are health implications. Some doctors, you know, feel health implication for women of childbearing age. Young men, heart issues called myocarditis. If you've already had the vaccine, do you really need it? And do you get sick from the vaccine? And some people's individual circumstances, you know, are not that great for vaccines. So that's the health implications. Then there's the fact that the vaccine was developed in record time, approved in record time, and some people are just naturally cautious when it comes to injecting things into their body that haven't stood the test of time. I don't think you see too many people, because we've had a polio vaccine for, 70 years. I don't think you see opposition to the polio vaccine, except maybe some religious opposition, but that's been proven safe and effective. And people have done the risk and benefit analysis and said, yes, get the polio vaccine. But that process took, several generations. And so this vaccine, because it's new, it's a different technology, it's just not as thoroughly vetted. People think it's safe, but it hasn't had the test of time that a polio or smallpox or other vaccines have had. So I think that plays into it too. And then there's the politics of it. I mean, you know, some people, it's become Democrats versus Republicans. And so, you know, some people say, okay, well, that makes me want to get the vaccine, and other people say it doesn't. I think all of this is playing out, and it comes down to just, it's very complicated in how people, approach it. I've talked to a lot of people, both pro-vaccine and people that are anti-vaccine, and I'm trying to sum it up as fairly and accurately as I can, you know, to talk about why people would want to get it or would not want to get it. And again, the fact that 80% of New Hampshire is vaccinated now is pretty good, I think. And people have done it on a voluntary basis. And, you know, they've weighed the benefits and they've weighed the risks and they've chosen, as I have, to get vaccinated.
Do you know, out of curiosity, what a vaccination costs? And I realize it's different in every country, but I'm talking about here in the U.S.
You know what? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. In our remaining couple of minutes, we get about 2 minutes left. Next Friday, of course, is Black Friday. There will be no show that day, as I will be spending some time with my family, which I'm looking forward to very much. However, do you have plans for the holiday, Senator?
Yeah, I'm going to spend the holiday with Karen's son and daughter-in-law, which we're looking really forward to.
Oh, it's fun. So you're not going to travel?
No.
Oh, good for you. I hear 54 million people are going to travel this weekend. Or that weekend. It should be next weekend, actually.
Well, I think that people that have been cooped up, you know, over the last couple of years are now saying it's time to get together and see family. I you know, went to see my kids this summer, Eric, and my daughter flew into Colorado from where she lives in the state of Washington. My three sons live in the same town in Colorado. I hadn't seen any of them in 2 years because of the pandemic. So I think Americans are, you know, they're cooped up. And I think this plays into, you know, the right track, wrong track issue that I was talking about previously.
Right. Okay. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. Senator Jeb Bradley, thank you very, very much for your time. Always appreciate your insight, and we'll talk in 2 weeks.
2 weeks. All right. Thank you.
All right. You take care.
All your listeners, have a great Thanksgiving, Eric. Thank you.
You as well, Senator. Thank you. All right, as we come up on 1 o'clock, the news is next on WASR.